As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. It's great to have you with us. I'm Ali Maxwell. I've got Michael Cox, Liam Tharm and Mark Carey from The Athletic with me. We're going to try and answer the question, how to play against a top team if within your own context and your own league, you are not that. So a tactical question, but one with plenty of interesting contextual branches as well. Guys, I'd like to see what you've been tweeting about in the build-up to a podcast just so I can judge what kind of mood you're in. It's very important that I prepare myself for that in my role. Michael, this week, talking about one of your favourite topics, kickoff times. And you might not have thought it, but you are able to use the word disgraceful to describe a kickoff time. So I'm expecting you to be fired up today.
Yeah, disgraceful specifically with the 8:15 evening kickoff time, which I think just makes it sometimes really difficult to get home, especially with the amount of stoppage time these days. Mm. So yeah, it really annoyed me. There was a game over Christmas, I think it was when Arsenal lost to West Ham. And the TV cameras, you know, focused on all the fans leaving the ground, you know, and obviously people like to mock them for leaving early. But like, some people just need to get the train home.
Disgraceful. Yeah. Liam, you quoted a tweet that detailed that Mickey van der Ven's top speed against Brentford was 10.38 metres per second. And also pointed out that Usain Bolt's average speed in his 100 metre world record sprint was 10.44 metres per second. But you said, I need everyone to do me a massive favour and not compare the average speed of a 100-metre world record to the maximal speed of any other sprint. It doesn't work like that.
No, my head got rather hot over a tweet, which I learned from Coxie maybe on that one. No, it was purely my athletic side showing of, don't compare a block start. And even then, obviously van der Ven's top speed, he didn't even touch Bolt's average, which is sort of from static, and I was told by a few people, don't take it too seriously, it's only a bit of fun, but why do that when you can moan about it instead?
He is quick, though.
He is quick. He's really quick. He's great fun to watch. We've said that on this pod numerous times. He's ridiculously athletic and a good balance of making great recovery runs and then still just flying into challenges as well.
So Liam's belligerent this week, and Mark, providing the light to our darkness, as always, you tweeted, oof. That equaliser makes for an even tastier game next week between Real Madrid and Girona.
Yeah, I'm not an avid tweeter, but I just thought I was watching the Atleti game and it does make for a big game. It's the top of the table clash, although Girona are kind of faltering a little bit. I know that we did a podcast including them recently, but it looks like Real Madrid are going to run away with it, which is a bit of a shame because Girona have been one of the most exciting stories across Europe this season.
So how to play against a top team? Simple question, but within that, a fair few different categories for us to talk through.
Yeah, we were sort of thinking in advance of how to categorise this because there's markedly sort of different approaches. And this is, I think, the interesting point of it, really. It's become, I think, slightly debated in terms of how teams approach it, sort of in terms of style. And some managers are now becoming increasingly dogmatic and saying, OK, if we're a team that primarily likes to attack or be possession heavy, we're going to stick with that against the best teams and say we'll try and sort of go toe for toe against them. They're sort of tactically flexible teams. Brighton do a lot to Zerbi, say, I'm going to stick with this and we're going to go press Man City, we'll try and play out. tactically flexible teams who tend to switch and go a bit more defensive. I think Wolves are a decent example. Brentford are probably the primary one under Thomas Frank, where they often play 4-3-3 and then switch to a 5-3-2. And then the third example really I could think of is teams who are primarily a bit more defensive anyway, a la West Ham, maybe Palace to a slight degree, that their primary way of setting up or playing and tend to suit those games a bit more anyway. They don't need to change as much. And they're the sort of three I would broadly categorise into.
Yeah, I mean, they were my three categories, so I'm not kind of disagreeing with Liam. But I, after saying that, I wonder whether there was a fourth one. Because I think there's quite a big difference between, say, like the way Dyche plays with Everton. They do react a bit, but they don't really need to. But then Brentford, even though they're quite defensive-minded in general, they are very flexible in terms of you don't really know what system they're going to play against one of the big clubs. So maybe there's a subcategory there. But yeah, it feels to me like it's more of an issue than ever for a couple of reasons. One, the inequality in the Premier League just means there is so much difference between playing against a top side and playing against a bottom half side. And second, because almost all the sides towards the bottom of the league now are trying to play good football. Mm. I mean, even 10 years ago, where you had a lot of sides like Bolton or Blackburn, who they almost revelled in their status as underdogs. And now you've got a side like, I think, Company's Burnley, probably the best example, who week in, week out want to play, broadly speaking, a Man City style of football. Can you do that against one of the big sides and still hope to win? Personally, I think it's very difficult. But also, it's very difficult to then play a completely different style of football.
That's it, isn't it? We've talked a lot about the fact that if you are in the bottom half of the table, for example, the most likely contributor to you staying up rather than going down will be your results against those around you. These games against what, I guess what would have previously been called the Big Six. Now in the Premier League, the landscape doesn't make that quite so simple, but broadly the top teams in the division, they are still very important to picking up points, but also within a tactical framework, the question of sticking to your guns or being adaptable, being pragmatic, and to what extent that provides a strength in terms of those individual games or potentially a weakness in terms of how coherent you can be on a match-to-match basis, I think is really interesting. So this is particularly relevant for fans of clubs outside the Premier League elite, whose objective at first and foremost is to survive and then use that hopefully as a platform to thrive as well. Let's chop up some of the examples of teams. We will be focused on the Premier League, but of course this topic has relevance to basically any football division. Why don't we start with a team like West Ham? Where do they fit into our categories here?
Well, I think West Ham are really interesting. There's probably a bit of a Mandela effect around them being really good against some of the top teams. Going back to the final season at the Berlin, where they were really good, admittedly, that was 2015-16. That was the season Leicester won the title and just the Big Six or the top sides didn't do as well, any of them. Obviously, that's why Leicester, as great as it was, won a relatively easier Premier League. So they've been really good this season. They've won away at Arsenal, which was Moyes' first win, beaten Arsenal at home as well in the Cup, beaten Manchester United at home, Chelsea at home. They've really sort of doubled down on their sort of defensive but structural play. I think there's a really interesting point, and I had a piece that went up before they played Manchester United, ironically lost, but actually had quite a good performance. Mm-hmm. Despite them being sort of low possession, their opponents had the second, and this is looking at the Big Six historically, had the second lowest total possessions against them. So they're not having a ton of different sequences. It's really extended periods of play where West Ham are sat in a defensive shape. Mm-hmm. Alvarez has slotted really well into midfield where he can shuffle into wide areas and track runners. They've got big lads in the box that can head and kick everything clear. And then when they need to, they can step up to press or they can make regains and they can attack. But they're really content to say, no, 1-2 minutes at a time, you can have the ball. We'll shuffle, we'll sit into a low block. And I thought that's an interesting way, and we'll come on to this later, but contrasting them to someone like Brentford, who've been a bit more transitional and have often got the ball and straight away gone long. Mm. I've quite enjoyed actually seeing West Ham in big games get the ball after sort of 5-10 minutes of defending and just circulating it. They'll quickly hit this really expansive shape. Alvarez drops in between the centre-backs often. Fullbacks really push on and they go, we'll take the sting out of the game. And I thought it's an interesting way of approaching actually the transition element of it, which really tends to be the key point in attack. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, Liam's piece on that recently on West Ham was brilliant. It might not be bigging yourself up, but it was a really interesting read. But it made me think about possession in general, of how it can be quite a misleading statistic, because you can use that as they didn't have much of the ball, therefore they weren't very dominant. But possession, not having that much possession doesn't mean you not necessarily have that much control. Mm-hmm. So especially with West Ham and David Moyes, they are still controlling the game even though they don't have the ball, and they'll go, they'll happily go minutes at a time without necessarily having the ball. And I think that it's hugely effective for the most part in the way that they like to play. They actually sometimes don't like it when they do have the ball and the onus is on them to actually try and create. But you know, then you think about the from the fans' perspective, it's been quite a contentious issue as to whether there should be more entertainment value. But yeah, I think it's important to distinguish control and possession because they're not necessarily the same.
Yeah, I think Moyes is an interesting one because he's got a reputation, I think rightly so, as being very reactive as a manager. I think one of the funny things about him, and you don't really see this anymore, about 10 years ago, whenever you're watching a game that didn't involve one of his teams, I swear like half the games, the cameras would focus in the stands and Moyes would be there watching. And you don't, I mean, I'd be interested to know why he doesn't seem to, I mean, did the cameras just not pick him out? Is scouting software so good that he doesn't feel the need? But he was at more games than anyone. And it was usually obviously against a team that was about to play his side. And I always thought while he kind of made it difficult for the big teams, his record was quite bad. I mean, famously, he didn't beat any of Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool away from home until that win at Arsenal recently. And so, yeah, his approach wasn't always particularly effective. And I think in a wider sense, I always feel like Moyes is in a slightly difficult situation where he's quite, I mean, he is quite defensive in his approach, I think. And I think supporters who watch his team week in, week out, tend to become quite frustrated with it. But he's not even so defensive that it becomes kind of like a brand, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not like they're Stoke or Allardyce's Bolton or even Brentford or Luton, where I think they really revel in the kind of like, yeah, you know, we're going to play a completely different style of football. We're going to make it really tough for you. West Ham, I think, in some ways try to play like a big club and they bring in players that I think could play for big clubs.
I was going to say their recruitment strategy certainly has not lent into that.
I think he's in a funny, I don't think there's too many managers like Moyes actually in terms of being somewhere in between the two categories.
And one thing that does or doesn't help, and you can look at this either way, is how effective they've been in Europe with a very similar style, that broadly what they play a lot of the time looks like sort of knockout football. And we've done whole podcasts on this, but it showed particularly against Bournemouth recently, where they went 1-0 down very early on at home. Calvin Phillips got pressed into making an error and gave Dominic Solanke a tap in, and then West Ham basically had to come out and control the game. And it looked quite awkward for them. That looked part of the reason that they've been so effective this season against better teams is they've primarily, I think, barring maybe City when they scored first and lost, down to some defensive errors and the fact City are so good and will punish teams, is they've scored first a lot, or they've stayed in games for a long period of time. And it's the same for any team that wants to play anyway against a better team, is your game plan's got to be fairly perfect. Mm. So you look at West Ham's goalkeepers this season, prior to playing Manchester United against the Big Six, prevented almost 4 goals more than expected, which was the best goalkeeping performance against those teams. And they had the best tackle success rate of any team against those opponents in about the last 5 years. So they were doing their style really, really well. When you go, it's not just a case of we have a game plan that makes us good between both boxes to minimise the chances they're getting. There's games where I think did Arsenal set a record for sort of touches in the opposition box in the game at the Emirates, and you have to be really good between the boxes to sort of minimise it, and then you still need to be exceptional there. And it's like you can't realistically sustain this for long periods of time, hence why we see teams have sort of a season or a couple of seasons doing really well against those teams. I think Palace had one a couple of seasons ago. Brentford had a season and have now sort of dropped off a lot compared to it. So whether you need to constantly change because top teams tend to evolve and play differently, or they sort of figure out what you're going to do and find solutions, I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, teams tend to seem to have a period.
Do you think these sorts of matches, Michael, are easier or more natural for teams that already play with a broadly direct style in possession, and out of it, those that more naturally defend deeper and more sort of structured block?
Yeah, definitely. And I think a good example here are Luton. They are struggling a bit, you can say, in the Premier League this season. I think that's expected considering where they've come from. At the moment, they're 1 point above the relegation zone. That's partly, of course, because Everton were deducted 10 points. But when you look at their performances at home against Liverpool, Manchester City, Arsenal and Chelsea, they haven't always got results, but they've really given those teams a tough game. And it's because they don't really have a decision to make in terms of how they're going to play. They've got the balance right. I mean, you look at the statistics overall this season, they've got the second least possession, second lowest pass completion rate, second highest in terms of aerials. But they don't actually play bad football. I don't think you watch them and think, God, this is tough to watch. They're just hammering long balls. They've got some really good technical players. And I think that one of the things that works for them is the system. And you can say any formation, you can say it looks different in different kind of states of the game. But I think when you play that approach that can look like 5-4-1 without the ball or 3-4-3 in possession, it is quite flexible. And of course, they've brought in some good players as well. I mean, Barkley has been excellent in midfield, I think, in particular. But yeah, I've been really impressed with Rob Edwards. And it's quite unusual for a young coach to play quite defensively. It almost seems to be like the young coaches are always... I mean, this is another issue. I think a lot of young coaches are basically careerists. Mm-hmm. And for example, take Vincent Kompany. He wants bigger jobs in the future. And so he's got to cast himself as a certain type of manager. And I'm not convinced that this is the best way for Burnley to play and stay up. I know they went down 2 years ago with the kind of Dyche style of football. But sometimes I just think they're being naive. And OK, you can say, trust the process. It's a long-term plan. They're developing young players. It's not a terrible approach. But yeah, I think sometimes it's just about the fact that Kompany, he can't play like Dyche if he wants to get a big job in the future. And I think that can be an issue.
I think endgame is a really important part of the discussion here, that teams and coaches, as Michael said, want to evolve to playing a certain style and having something to work towards. Often this is what we're talking about, is playing in a reactive way, often being defence first. That can't really scale up anywhere because you're just constantly saying, well, how do the other team play? Who are the players that we need to stop? You're not working towards saying, well, there's these patterns we want to implement, or these ways of attacking, these metrics we can look at of field tilt, of, you know, our final third output that we can really start to control. And it's really a case of you're just trying to be really stubborn and really frustrating. Michael and I were at the Brentford City game on Monday, and it was quite funny in Guardiola's press conference afterwards that Phil Foden scored a hat-trick, and the first question he got asked was, you know, how good was Phil today? Can you talk about that? And he was like, Brentford are so hard to play against. He's looked so drained by the fact, you know, just having this team that are going, okay, back five, midfield three, just completely congesting those central spaces. And then he was already going about having to play them again in sort of 2 weeks' time in the reverse fixture. So yeah, it's become more of a footballing cultural argument, I suppose, is the best way to look at it, where this was historically a way, or these principles of how England teams played in the late 90s with, you know, what at time was a research-driven way of playing. People seem to forget that research has now been built upon, which is how research works. People find things out and then you test them more. I think there's become this over-desperation now to move away from that and play more like the Spain teams of the early 2000s, the French, the Germans. And people now say, okay, have we maybe gone too far? And there's still a place for these teams to play in that more defensive way.
Yeah, I mean, the guy spoke about Brentford and Luton, and I think whatever the sort of the style may be, it not necessarily having to be quick and direct or whatever it is, as long as maybe against the top teams, it's more jarring to play against, whereby it's something a little bit different. And, you know, Michael mentioned Burnley, I'd maybe say Norwich of seasons gone by, maybe a Watford to a certain extent, where they don't really have that clearer style, or they try and implement a style that's the same as the top teams but just a simply poorer version, to which you're then going to get, you know, beaten by those better teams. So those more creative teams, if you like, a Sheffield United under Chris Wilder in the first instance with two overlapping centre backs, the Marcelo Bielsa Leeds, where it was a really man marking aggressive out of possession style and in possession style, very direct. Brentford, as Liam mentioned, with their hybrid shape, ability to adapt, but their ability to use set pieces so well as well. And Luton, as Michael said. So I think as long as it's something that is a little bit jarring, that seems to be, there's a pattern there of having the most success.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Brentford seem like the most relevant team to this whole discussion, not only because Pep Guardiola is visibly drained, having just tried to solve the problems that Brentford provoke. They also have an incredible record for a team of their stature and league position against the top teams in the division. And probably most interestingly for the discussion, they don't just do what they always do. They do mix and match, they do tweak, they react to their opposition, which, considering it's so successful, I'm now wondering why more teams don't do this, Liam. Can you explain exactly what they do and why it might be difficult to achieve for another team?
Yeah, I can. I mean, Thomas Frank largely explained what they did on Monday Night Football a while back, so I can just sort of take directly from him. And I put some of that in the piece on Monday night, which, again, is an interesting wrinkle now to the discussion that against both City and Spurs, they went ahead in the game and then had errors. They had spells in the game where they sort of faded and drifted and ended up losing both of them. So largely it's, well, it was quite good because he said to Jamie Carragher there, like, it's always a 5-3-2. They tend to drop the wing-backs very deep into a flat-back five. The eight, I think he called it, so the outside central midfielder will tend to come across, and they basically want to make 3v3s out wide or 4v3s, so having a player advantage to, you know, deny teams that chance to progress. I wonder if that's still as much the case now, where, and it was a good example against City, where Phil Foden was nominally on the left but rolled inside and into midfield, and it was basically only Oscar Vardiol that was pushing forward. So you're looking now at teams really packing the central areas even more. And I think the result from that was, in the second half at least, I could see Neil Maupay was dropping really deep into the defensive third a lot of the time. So that's a striker dropping in onto Rodri. And it largely did work. The problem was they had errors. And I think the third goal in particular was the exact sort of goal where the ball goes through the middle. I think it's Rodri who plays it into Haaland, who no one gets close to him, and he can set it into Foden's path and dribble through. And you go, that's the exact goal you're set up to defend against, to control those central areas. So look, it worked really well last season. I think it was them and Brighton who took the most points against the big six, which is interesting because they're really contrasting styles. But I don't just want to profile Brentford as a low block team here, because they do a lot of man-for-man pressing as well, and they tend to push into that from those high positions. But then against teams now that tend to put players into midfield from sort of fullback, especially against Spurs, that they tended to suffer a bit there. And I also wonder if their tendency to go maybe a bit too direct at times when they do win it back and not always keep it, a la West Ham, means sometimes they don't actually have a spell of possession. They can get a counter-attack, but if they lose it, then it's suddenly another wave to defend, another wave to defend.
I mean, it's a question as much as anything, but I want to hear from you guys on the, is it sort of made easier to be a little bit more flexible because each team typically has a principle of play, which is a bit more standardised, shall we say, and then the tweaks come from more of the tactical side of it, maybe if it is just moving from a back four to a back five, whereby it's only the change really in the spaces and the distances between certain players, but the approach is largely consistent. I suppose if it was asking a team to be completely different in their style, more so than personnel and specific tactics, that would maybe show them to struggle a little bit more, and the message itself would be potentially inconsistent. You might not get the buy-in from the players, but is the sort of the thread throughout the fact that these teams are maybe adapting sometimes, but the principles of play are largely the same in and out of possession?
I'd say so. I mean, City this season are on track to become possibly the first Premier League team to win the league with over 90% pass completion. And I looked back as far as I could on, I think, who scored. And in 2009, 2010, Chelsea and Arsenal, who were first and third, were the only teams with more than 80%. So in not a ridiculously long period of time, just over a decade in football, you can see just how pass heavy that's become. And I think there's now a lot of synergy in terms of the spaces that top teams tend to occupy. And we've talked about this before, of even if you compare moving sort of a fullback or a halfback, as Michael likes to call it, inside, that they'll do that in different ways because they've got, you know, if it's Arsenal wanting to attack with their wingers primarily, compared to say Spurs and sort of overloading the half spaces and trying to make cutbacks, that it's sort of, as you say, same principles of, we tend to want to attack through those five vertical lanes. We want to control possession in sort of the structure and have the rest defence organised, but it's down to their personnel, right? And the coaches will always say that, of exactly your shape might be tweaked. I think Wolves were a great example when Gary Neil again went on Monday Night Football and was saying that they went man for man against City on the left side, where I think it was Totti stepping out to Foden, and they were sort of stacked up more on the right hand side because that's where Haaland, they'd worked out, wanted to make all those runs, and it was to deny him that way. So yeah, the principles, I think, as you say, stay the same. And then you get those tiny tweaks, which I think from a naked eye, if you just looked at a shape or a structure, you'd go, well, it's the same thing every time. And you go, it is, until that pass goes there. And then some of the movements are slightly different compared to the previous game.
Who are the current teams that would occupy what we might call the toe-to-toe category? Those that refuse to adapt or comply. Who would stand out this season, Michael?
Well, in terms of game plan and mentality, probably Brighton. It depends how we mean adapt. I mean, they are very flexible in terms of changing system every week. Liam will be able to speak about it more than me, but I don't think they necessarily adapt more against the big sides than they would against the smaller sides. I think they just are very flexible. I mean, there aren't... I mean, Burnley, as we mentioned, are a poor side trying to play good football. But I'm not sure there's anyone really punching above their weight with possession football. Maybe you could say Bournemouth would be a good example. But when I think back a while, you know, someone like Brendan Rodgers at Swansea, I think they were quite interesting where they came up and they did try to keep the ball probably more than anyone in the league apart from Arsenal at that point, and finished, I think, 9th or 10th in their first season. I don't quite see anyone in that mould. But yeah, maybe Bournemouth would be the best example. But I think of them being really about pressing first and foremost more than possession play.
I think Villa deserve a massive shout here, that they tend to play in quite a structured way. And I think that's probably one of the key points, the same as Brighton. So a lot of their build-up can be very sort of pattern-based, very repeatable, that it often looks, you know, in the same way, going into the same players, the first sort of, or different variations of the same, you know, two or three passes in a row. And that I think in terms of implementing it very quickly, both De Zerbi and Emery very quickly had success. Not quite in a shock factor sense, but in a sense of before teams can catch on, if you can, you know, access a number nine very quickly and then suddenly set it into a midfielder and you've bypassed 6 or 7 outfielders. And again, a big part of this now we need to point out is that because a lot of teams play short, a lot of teams now tend to press really high. So if you can get really good at playing out and building out really well, then suddenly you're going to get into situations where you've kind of got 6 players from each team all in that team's defensive third, and then it's like a 3v3 or a 4v4 on the halfway line. And if you can access that, well, that's in a great position. You've got all the space to play into. I think that Spurs got the Etihad as a prime example. So yeah, I'd give Villa massive credit for that, particularly I think the games against Arsenal, but City especially, where they use those sort of wingers that aren't wingers. It's kind of the old Moyes, the is it the false winger used to be called, where they'd sort of roll inside and play more like sort of number 10s. And there's parts of that then become, I think, predictable, and when it works, it can work really well, and when it fails even worse. You're not going to get West Ham going to a big six team or a top six team or at home and completely blowing them away, but you're also probably not going to get them crashing and burning. Whereas, you know, with Villa, you had them go to Newcastle and their high line got completely picked apart, but then they can beat, you know, top teams repeatedly at home. Brighton went to Arsenal and got completely pressed to absolute death in the first half, and Ahmed Waleed wrote a really good piece on that that's on site and just could not get out of their half. So it's going to sort of raise the ceiling of your successes and I think lower the floor of your failures. And as we were saying before, in terms of sort of how a lot of upcoming managers now want to play or head coaches, I think they're prepared to take those as long as it's in a net positive. And I broadly agree with that, but I also get that there's those games where it happens and it goes completely wrong and people go, what on earth are you doing? You need to rip up the side and change it completely.
I mean, yeah, just on the note of refusing to adapt or not, you know how much I like to look at my research studies for different topics. And I found a 2023 study, and it was conducted by a group of researchers at Sheffield Hallam University. And they basically looked at the adaptability in playing style as a determinant of team performance and success as a consequence. And the findings aren't overly surprising, but they looked at nearly 22,000 matches played across the top 5 European leagues from 2014-15 to 2019-20. And they basically found that the ability of teams to flexibly vary their playing style throughout the season was positively associated with team performance. So if you're able to generate and adapt to different playing styles throughout the season, you're more likely to have more offensive and defensive success, so winning more games. So, you know, this is largely what we've seen in the Premier League, and to Liam's point about the subtle tweaks actually could be associated with a change in playing style. If you thought about it like that, it does show that maybe a staunchly dogmatic approach maybe isn't the best way to go.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I always had this idea about Eddie Howe's Bournemouth that I wanted to bring up, which was that they would play, to my eyes, a very attack-minded style of play as their go-to in all games. And against the top teams, it felt like they regularly got beaten 4-0, 5-1, because they refused to adapt. They tried to go toe-to-toe, but the realities of football and budgets and talent advantage chopped them down somewhat. And I always wondered whether their idea behind doing that was to give them strength in games when they played those around them in the league table, so that they were more comfortable taking the game to an opposition against whom they were more on a level playing field. I mean, is there any way of proving or disproving that, or saying that is a good or ultimately a naive approach?
Probably not proving it, but again, to look at Burnley, who I think are the best example, you look at their games against the other promoted sides. Home to Sheffield United, they won 5-0. Away at Luton, they won 2-1. And of course, in that home game against Luton, I think they were very unlucky not to win because of that controversial late goal that Luton scored. So yeah, I mean, they are good when they're playing against, with respect, kind of championship level opposition.
As you talk, I wonder whether the, you know, I keep talking about when you play the teams around you against whom you're battling for survival. Has that group of teams got a little smaller? Because we've got Aston Villa in fourth. We've got Newcastle having had a fantastic 2 years or so. Brighton, we discuss, project themselves as a top team, certainly in the way that they play and when they're at their best. I wonder whether actually the fixtures I'm saying are most important. I wonder if there's fewer of them now than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that in terms of historically, maybe when you're talking about Eddie Howe at Bournemouth, the quote-unquote big six was a little bit more of a thing, where if you were to then extrapolate that, you'd think that the games that the teams are playing against the big six accounts for about one third. So the majority are teams who are there or thereabouts, you know, around you, or maybe, you know, a little bit better. So you kind of want to play the percentages there and think, okay, we'll back ourselves maybe against more teams around us. But as you say, that's not the case anymore. So I don't know. I do like the Eddie Howe principle of kind of getting that consistency, that buy-in, but for the reasons that you outlined, of it's, yeah, a small pool, really, probably four or five now teams who are battling relegation, maybe, where previously it was maybe closer to eight. I don't think we can put it in that category anymore.
So you do need to accrue points against the toughest possible opposition, probably more important at the moment than in previous eras. In terms of pushing you for some conclusions here, because we've tried to give an overview of the different approaches, I know that you guys aren't going to want to put your heads too far above the parapet and say you have to play this formation and this style in order to win points against the top teams. But broadly, in terms of principles or how you would communicate might be the best way to be thinking about this, Liam, where would you start? What's the best approach?
Well, I think you have to factor in, if you're putting yourself in the shoes of an inferior team against superior opposition, that if you're going to have to play or defend particularly, you know, in accordance with how they're going to attack, then the fact that they tend to put so many bodies now, and particularly look at fullbacks coming inside and nines dropping in, that can be sort of primarily less goal scorers than ever before, it can make a lot of sense to fill up with players at the back, because you go, normally the solution of how you break down a 5-3-2 or any sort of back five like that tends to be trying to cross from wide areas and hitting the striker. I think of the goal Kane scored away to Brentford, I think last season, where it's a deep in swinging cross, and you know, the one thing you can't physically stop is the player putting the cross in, and then you have to defend the aerial duel. Mm. It's the same reason why it works when teams want to play long from the goalkeeper, because you can't stop the goalkeeper kicking it long. You just have to set up to defend it. Whereas obviously if they want to play through the third, you can try and put a shape around that. So I think there's increasingly a space for that. But again, it's the same now. I always come back to the point, I think the best teams now are adaptable. I think Inter, and this isn't a Premier League team here, but Inter Milan under Simone Inzaghi are a really great example of that, that I'd encourage anyone to watch, that I imagine they'll go into the latter rounds now of the Champions League and have a really strong defensive base, but then they go into top games in Serie A and they beat Juventus in the Derby d'Italia just this weekend past, and spent the whole game pretty much camped in Juve's half, having one of their left wing back, DiMarco, sort of on the last line, running in behind, their right centre back with effectively an assist, trying a bicycle kick in the opposition box. So sure, they've got the budget relative to their league. It's not quite the same thing. But if you can do that part of it as part of your game, then it's going to be really helpful when you play sides that play the antithesis of those big teams.
Because it's kind of my job to try and put puzzle pieces together, I'm going to put something out there and you can shoot me down. If we did have to pick a team this weekend to play against Manchester City, Michael, given that the top teams, as you guys have been writing about for years now, almost always attack with a front line of five players now stretching across the pitch, and that defending that front five with four defenders can provide problems quite often with overloads at the back post, it feels like we'd probably select a back five out of possession, a five-man defensive line. Liam's also talked about the need to squeeze central areas as much as possible, because what a waste of time it is having defenders if you're just allowing the opponents through the front door and through the middle of you, which leads me to think that at least three central midfielders to play in front of the back five but to defend that central area are quite important. What do we do above that? Do you like a fixed front two in order to try and provide a really genuine threat on the counter-attack if you can get those first few passes right in transition? Or do you have to lean into, we are going to be defending 75% of the time, so maybe another more defensive-minded body in the form of more of an attacking midfielder or even a wide player? How would you sort of look at it?
It's tough. I mean, me and Lynn went to the Brentford game on Monday, and I did like the way they played with two up front, and they had two options, Tony and Mopai, very different players, and obviously that paid off for the goal. So I think that was quite a good advert for playing two up front. I think City, they're so tough to play against now because they've just got this back four of four proper centre-backs at times, or Kyle Walker, who's obviously very quick, very good defender. So it is difficult, I think, to know really how you get at City as a smaller side. I mean, the best, I think, in the league this year has probably been Wolves when they won 2-1 against City. And they were very cautious. But they also pressed well in midfield. They gave Kovacic and Nunes a really tough time. So they didn't go full defensive, full negative kind of football, but they knew that they had to kind of force turnovers and then build transitions from there. So it's tough to say in terms of shape, but there's obviously different ways to go about it.
I mean, yeah, Wolves was going to be my example as well. And I was, in preparation for this podcast, was looking at the Gary O'Neill clip on Monday Night Football, and he was saying, and he showed just how well Mateus Cunha did on Kovacic, to make sure that anytime he received the ball, it was him who was just helping out the midfield and making sure that they could break in numbers, because there were times when they had a 3v3 and then exposed that with the pace of Pedro Neto, etc. But Gary O'Neill would be a really good example of that. Well, Michael spoke about it before, but that pragmatism to be like, we can adapt, still have the same principles of play. And he spoke about it really well and on Monday Night Football, and said a big key to me is being adaptable and flexible. I'd love to go to Manchester City and press. I'd love to have 70% of the ball, but is that going to happen? And are we going to win the game? Probably not. So he said, which I thought was really interesting, how far do I need to move away from my ideal to give us the best chance of winning in this game? So it's a continuum. How far do I need to move? I probably do a little bit, as all teams do, but just how far does that need to go? And then in that clip as well, it was really interesting where he said that, thinking about the fans, depending on if you're, you know, a smaller team and you're at home, to get that buy-in from the fans and not have them grumbling, booing at halftime, whatever it is. He said that the team showed enough on the occasions that they did break forward and created a chance, or even an opportunity that didn't come into fruition in the end, that when they did counter-attack, it showed to the fans that stick with us, because this is the right idea, even though we're suffering for 10, 15 minutes at a time. So the Wolves game was a great example of that.
And certainly their win over Chelsea over the weekend followed a absolutely fantastic blueprint, and it just looked everything that went well for Wolves looked like a function of game plan. It wasn't random what happened there. They followed a fantastic game plan.
Yeah, the pressing and midfield on Caicedo in particular looked quite similar. Obviously, we then got to mention that they'd lost in the week 4-3 at home to Manchester United and been a lot less well-structured defensively. So it's obviously really hard to play. I think it's even harder now than ever to play against those top teams with the depth that they've got. The fact probably the game's gone even longer now. There's just an extra 5 minutes to defend. And, you know, one of the things Guardiola said on Monday was just quality tends to show through eventually. I wonder as well if it's particularly difficult now as we see more of those teams which are good but not quite great. So I'm thinking of the Brighton, the Aston Villa, the West Ham, who playing Europe now as well and having to balance that and trying to then, if you play one of these teams hypothetically on a Sunday or at any point in the season, you've just got an extra, what is it so far from the group stages, 6 games and the travel and the workload within that to add in. And I don't have the number specifically to hand, but from memory, you tend to have higher physical outputs when you're defending and not always intensity stuff because, you know, unless you're pressing high, that can be more sort of in transition. But you then just get into the realms of suffering from success a little bit, don't you? So I think Wolves are an interesting case study this season to see how, when they play those teams again in reverse fixtures, do they do the same thing? How do the other teams adapt relative to them? Because I think that tends to be a good litmus test of, I guess, just how adaptable the coaches and how good the players are. Again, one point I don't know if we've mentioned, but it comes down to the profiles of players you've got available as well. You look at Maximilian Kilman, he's a really good technician, but he's probably about 6'4", 6'5". Totti's very big. Craig Dawson's been a phenomenal box defender at West Ham and at Wolves now. And they've got, I think, Nkunya, Pedro Neto, especially phenomenal players on the break, and the sheer pace they've got. It makes sense because it's a player's game. At the end of the day, you've got to use the types of players that you've got. And I guess then it's how do you build them into a more possession team becomes the bigger part of the question for someone like Gary O'Neill.
Yeah, last season, Wolves didn't score a goal against City, Arsenal or Manchester United in their 6 fixtures against them. They picked up 4 points from 12 games against the top 6 in the Premier League. This season, they've already picked up 7 points from games against current top 6 teams, and they still have 5 fixtures to play, albeit 4 of them are away from home. So just adding an attacking strategy against these teams that has them a little scared, and for good reason, really does make a massive difference, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's one tiny caveat to that, is I think they've got the same points under Gary O'Neill now as Lopetegui had, and they've played identical games under O'Neill as what they played under Lopetegui, and the records are like practically identical. So then it becomes a case of who do you want to get your points from? Mm. It probably is, from a fan's perspective, more fun to beat a big 6 team at home or go away and win. But then the actual impact of if you beat a team around you as well can be actually more powerful because, you know, it's then they don't gain on you and you gain away from them.
Definitely, probably another whole episode about something that came to mind when Michael was talking about West Ham and this almost identity issue of what are you going to be and what matters to fans really deep down? What matters to fans? Is it entertainment or is it points? And how much can you marry the two if you are a team in their situation? We haven't spoken about Palace today at all, but that feels very pertinent to their current situation as well. Lastly, is there anything on this front when we talk about elite teams playing against each other and how much Manchester City or Liverpool or Arsenal have to adapt from their pretty consistent ideals when they come up against teams that are their equal? You can't both have the ball is often something that we say when we're previewing games between teams that like to dominate possession. So what happens in these instances?
I think back to the Etihad game when City beat Arsenal and City went long an awful lot and had De Bruyne sort of playing off of Haaland. And similarly, in the fixture at the Emirates earlier on this season when Arsenal beat City 1-0 and there was the late goal and Tomiyasu, you know, running upfield and making a knockdown that it's not, I think, quintessentially the type of goal you'd expect to see or you would estimate to come out of a fixture like that.
And Michael, some relevance to the big fixture from last weekend in the Premier League as well, with Mikel Arteta's Arsenal and Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool going head-to-head. And you wrote about Arteta going with what you're calling double tens. I'm calling it a strikerless formation.
I'd agree. I mean, it wasn't what I called it. It was what Klopp called it.
Right.
So Arsenal played that way in the FA Cup game and Klopp said, "Cool, that was really difficult to play against." So Arteta just played the same way again.
And what is that? And why does Klopp find it so difficult to play against?
Well, they had two players in the, I'd say, in the channels between the lines, Odegaard to the right, Havertz to the left, and they were just always trying to tempt Van Dijk and Konate out of position. And I think it gave Liverpool's midfield and centre-backs a lot of issues. Essentially, it was four against three in midfield. Van Dijk, I think, had one of his worst games I've ever seen, really, in terms of being dragged around all over the place. So, yeah, they did find it tough to play against. I agree, I wouldn't really call either of those players number 10s, really. They're too wide to be number 10s for me. But, yeah, there you go.
Something you said the other day about Firmino springs to mind here, which is that centre-backs always said they hated playing against him because they didn't really know where he was. They didn't know whether to get tight to him or whether that's exactly what he wanted to create space in behind them. And broadly similar theme there, except it's Arsenal now doing it against Klopp's Liverpool. I suppose it's still, you still have to have some sort of threat in behind, don't you? So the wide forwards coming inside and making those clever runs too.
Yeah, exactly. And Havertz for the first goal as well. I actually didn't think Havertz did that enough. I think there were a few occasions where he could have gone in behind. Don't think that really comes naturally to him. But yeah, it was a very effective system.
The rich tapestry of Premier League tactics gives us content every single week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. This week was no different. Thank you to Liam for the idea this week. We hope that you enjoyed this discussion. If you have any follow-ups, you can get in touch with us individually on Twitter, but there's also a section of the Athletic app where this podcast lives. You can listen to the podcast through the app without ads, and you can comment as well on the specific episode page if you have any further queries or questions or anything that you'd like to emit to us. Thank you for listening, and do so again next week, please, on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, and sign up to The Athletic today at theathletic.com/tactics. Go well.
The Athletic.